Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Why Does the Hubble Constant Change So Much? The Hubble Constant, a number we use to measure the expansion of the universe. This is the number that explains how fast it is expanding, right? And we know it's expanding. Things are getting, I mean, there's more parking space today than there has been in the history of the universe.
For instance. Are you sure?
Well,
I'd like
yes.
to know where you work.
Rick's at UK, maybe parking space not
they
quite
don't
as...
sell parking passes anymore. They sell hunting licenses.
But at any rate, there are several different ways you can measure the background cosmic radiation. You know, this is the kind of the after effects of the Big Bang. Or you can do something, they call it a distance ladder measurement. But every single time they try a different method to try to figure out this Hubble constant, they get really dramatically different values. We just cannot figure out how fast the universe is expanding. Now, the interesting thing is, the same thing happens in politics and in life. You know, we don't understand Brexit, or we don't understand why Iran does what it does, or the pro-gun lobby, or you pick your
Why don't you
group.
Pick something a lot less complex and understand? We don't understand that either.
Well, you think these things are more complex than the origin of the universe, though, Rick. And the point is, you know, they don't say, well, gee, the Hubble constant, we got a different value because Bob's lab is a jerk, or Larry doesn't know how to calibrate the equipment. We just say we have to change our understanding. I feel like there are some situations in our society where we need to change our understanding of people's motivations or of a group of people. I feel like that we could learn something from the physicists, the astrophysicists, the cosmologists. We could learn something new. And that's all I'm saying. Plus, I have several attitude changes in this show. This all came together, and I said, that's perfect. I read this. I don't understand the origin of the universe, certainly. Don't even know how you do this distance ladder method. I read it, and I still don't understand it. But I know that we can't figure out how fast the universe is expanding, even though it is.
We can't figure out how fast it's contracting either.
Well, things are certainly not getting closer to each other. We can say that here even in our studio. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, and a special radio wave to those fine folks at the MSU Ronald G. Eaglin Space Science Center with me to talk about whatever they want to talk about, clearly not necessarily what I have prepared, from the University of Kentucky, Shelley Irving, assistant professor in the Physician Assistant Program. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
We are back at full strength, and with us to talk about our internet presence.
Hopefully we'll talk about more than that.
The Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure at the University of Kentucky, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. But for the next 60 seconds, we could talk about the internet presence that is Health Matters. And it comes in two forms. You can go to wmky.org and get the audio of the show. Now, you don't just type that in and all of a sudden, boom, there's the audio. You got to go to a menu. You got to find Health Matters. You got to go to a little area of the website devoted to Health Matters. Then you'll see a list of shows. Then you can click on the show. Then you can click on the link and listen to the show. It's really easy. It's only like 17 steps. Come on, that had to be... Tony, you didn't even laugh at that.
I know. I'm just wondering, is it expanding?
It's as,
or is it
it's as easy
and,
as your electronic medical record.
Keep going.
After a few clicks, we can get to the audio. We can listen to the show. We can, you know, put it on our device. We can listen driving down the road. We can send it to a friend. There's all kinds of things you can do, but the key is you can listen to the show. After that, you need to interact with the show. And to do that, we have a fan page on Facebook. It's facebook.com/HMRadioShow. And from there, you can interact with Health Matters. That's a site that's not – we don't have professional monitors on there for us. We actually look at the content. We actually post content. It's a group effort between staff and it's your way to leave us – tidbits of information. Maybe that's feedback on the show and how you liked it, or maybe how Tony wasn't really funny that day. There's all kinds of things you can do from a feedback standpoint. You can also suggest show topics, which, you know, once again, you're kind of at Tony's mercy. But hey, I say go and ask him. That's the place. You can leave a comment about, I don't know, I guess you could leave a comment about just about anything, but we really prefer it kind of be about health. Isn't
sure.
that right? Isn't that better? It's easier for you to answer.
Yeah, or somebody could explain to me how the universe is expanding. That'd be useful too.
Oh, yeah, I don't think we even want to go there with that with you. But nonetheless, if you have two-way interaction that you would like to do, if you would like to interact with the show, that is where you go. You go to our fan page at Facebook, and that can be found at facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, Vertigo. This one's for you, Carolyn. That's right. Carolyn interacted with us on the Facebook page. She says, and I'm not quoting this, but I'm paraphrasing.
You're trying
she says,
to.
We've been to several specialists with some problems with vertigo, and they seem to be somewhat vague about what's going on. And she says, can you clarify? And the answer is No,
we can't.
Well, I mean, and not that we joke about people's condition because we try not to do that, but in this case, no, we can't.
No. It is, and I will tell you why. This has bothered me since my medical school days, the vagueness of the whole construct of vertigo and what we call inner ear problems. But we will do our best, Carolyn, because you have a valid complaint.
But she listened.
Yeah, she did.
Because she deserves that.
Yeah, and I
will
tell you.
It's the least we can do.
Yeah, it's not that necessarily that the doctors are bad, although we think many of them are, but that's not the point here. The point is they're discussing a subject about which we know less than the Hubble constant. Dizziness. First of all, dizziness in general is an umbrella term. It could be anything from feeling like you're going to faint when you stand up, from what we call disequilibrium, where you're not really sure which way's up, to vertigo. Now, vertigo is very specific, though. It is a sensation that you are spinning or your surroundings are spinning, they're in motion around you. And it is a very uncomfortable feeling that causes nausea. As a matter of fact, I saw in my work on this, one ear, nose, and throat guy said, and it makes sense, if you are dizzy and you feel like you're going to throw up, you probably have vertigo. That is not really a common symptom of just simply being passing out because your blood pressure gets low, or a faint, such as when you see blood or something like that. So vertigo is a very specific term. You have nausea. You either sense your body moving in space or your surroundings are moving. The second thing that I want to point out, and we've got, of course, our 10 fun facts as always, but this is the second one. It is a disorder of the vestibular apparatus. It's a vestibular disorder. Now, when you think about a person's ear, first of all, there is the thing that you see, and you can put earrings and glasses and things like that on. That's called the outer ear. The pinna or auricle is the outside part of the ear. And then, of course, it's a tube that goes to the middle ear. That tube ends in your eardrum. We call it the tympanic membrane. And that middle ear consists of the tympanic membrane and three small bones and a eustachian tube that hooks over to the back of your nose. Then just on the other side of the middle ear is the inner ear. That's the cochlea, containing the nerves for hearing, the vestibule, the receptors for balance, and the semicircular canals, fluid-filled canals that help your body understand which way is up. And that is the inner ear, then, inside your eardrum, sealed off from the outside world, in just past your cochlea. That's the inner ear. Now, the same nerve sends your hearing signals and your balance signals to the brain. And so then there can be several different things that happen to that nerve, and we will get into that in our second fractional portion. For now, we know the anatomy of the ear, and we know that vertigo is a spinning sensation, and we'll stop with that. That's our sponsor, Vertigo. This one's for you, Carolyn. We start, again, with I think this is a change in understanding, and I really like this. Kelsey Piper wrote this in Vox on August 14th. Super centenarians, people who live to more than 110 years old. There are places where a lot of people who live to over 110 seem to live. Sardinia, Italy, Okinawa, places like that.
None of them are anywhere near your house, right?
Exactly.
No.
Exactly.
So if I move there, will I live longer?
Well, let me explain. Justin Newman, Biological Data Science Institute at Australian National University, started looking at the United States. And you may, I mean, I'll ask our radio fans in the U.S., do you know anyone who's over 110 years old? I don't. I have never treated anyone over 110 years old. What Saul Justin Newman found out, the state-specific introduction of birth certificates was associated with a 70 to 80% fall in the number of people who were aged over 110. When we started keeping records, all of a sudden, all these 110-year-olds evaporated. Then he looked at the hotspots in Italy and Japan, and they happened to be areas of high crime rates, low life expectancy in general, and then there were these people. these 110 years old people. He thinks they're lying.
Interesting.
It's one way to talk about it.
Yeah. He says, look, you know, there's nothing about them. Like I said, these are places that don't have very good records. Also, if you say you're 110, you're getting some type of a senior citizen benefit or a retirement benefit or something like that. And if you can start that early on and keep going up through age, theoretically 110, you can pick up a lot of money. And he points out it's a lot like a disease. You know, if you have a disease and it's a very rare disease, if we test... if the disease is, say, affects only one in a million people, the test, it may be 99.99% accurate, but still there's 100 false positive tests for every true positive. That's the nature of very rare things. So if people who live to be 110 are very rare, the majority of the ones who test positive for being 110 are going to be false positives, just like a rare disease. And it makes sense to me. Like I said, I wondered why.
Well, I mean, I think I could get in line with that if I knew for a fact they didn't have a birth certificate, right?
Right.
But there are the places where it is documented. You know, I'd be curious to know if any of these locations cited had official birth certificates that went back that far without, you know, without the courthouse burning down,
right,
or they're losing a bunch of records, something
right.
like that.
Well, let's say you have an official birth certificate. I mean, I see where you're going with this, but what happens if you have an official birth certificate and you're in a place that might have experienced World War II, might have experienced some type of a civil war or some type of upheaval, and all of a sudden you assume someone else's identity? The birth certificate's there, it's just not yours. So you can see there's several ways I can get to age 110. Other than living to 110, I could lie.
It seems far-fetched to me, though. I'd almost have to leave my community, go to a new community, and assume an identity, and then say I'm older.
Well,
because if you're already 90 or 85, you probably know the people around you already.
Right. Now, that's the great thing.
And they know your name.
If you are 90, though, you're the only one left who knows when you were young. So suddenly you're not Roger, you're Ralph. There's no one to challenge you on that because the people that know you are Roger are dead.
Do you believe that?
I do.
See,
because I talked to my dad about it. I said, look, Dad, you know, he was telling stories about the family. And I said, whatever you say is the truth because there's no one around who can contradict you
anymore. But those people he was talking about were already dead.
Yeah.
No, we're talking about your dad. Could your dad get away with being 110 and nobody know who your dad was?
I will be honest with you. My dad had two birthdays, one of which was true and one of which was convenient.
Well, most people on Facebook have different birthdays, and they move them around so they can get the free cake at, you know.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And there were official documents, which, you know, as his son and working on his estate after he passed, the official documents were divided which birthday they believed. Now, they were only about 4 months apart. But yes, I believe, you know, you go back 100 years and things are not nearly as precise and as neat as they are now.
That describes this show right there. Not pristine, not neat, a little messy.
So why don't you take a break and you can come back to Health Matters, the absolute greatest and oldest show on the internet, on the radio today. We're going to take a break as well, and we're going to come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Why Does the Hubble Constant Change So Much show. We are thinking about changing attitudes, changing our understanding of things. We are trying to understand vertigo and inner ear problems. And we're also trying to understand aging. And super old people, as it turns out, may not actually be super old. And so the point is, some of the research, when they said, well, how did you get to be 110? Well, no one says, well, I lied. I assumed someone else's birth certificate. They just say, well, you know, I've drink cognac or I eat grapes or whatever you do. But it may be a little bit simpler than that. It calls into question, really, how reliable our information is on people that are aged over 110. Now, I've had a number of patients that I think are reliably over 100, but no one over 110.
Have you seen their birth certificates?
No, but they look like they were 100.
Well, now, look, to be fair, in Eastern Kentucky, you don't have to be over 100 to look like you're over 100.
Fair enough. You are telling the truth there. But I will say, you know, it bothered me. I always wondered how come, working as a healthcare professional, I've worked in a number of different hospital systems, and I've never seen a person hospitalized over age 110. And if you have, then fine. Write us on the Facebook page, and I will gladly, if you feel you have a reliable 110-year-old person in your hospital, or you've taken care of them, or you know them, please let me know about it, because I will be a skeptic until someone convinces me otherwise. Our sponsor for the second time, Vertigo. This one's for you, Carolyn. Carolyn has written in with some issues about being dizzy and vertigo, and the explanations she got from her doctors were somewhat vague, and we are in the process of saying why. If you remember last time, fun fact number one, vertigo is that sensation that you are spinning or the room is spinning around you. It is not simply dizziness or lightheadedness. It is a very specific sensation, and it's often accompanied by nausea, as if you had just stepped off of a roller coaster or a merry-go-round or something that made you go in circles. It is a vestibular disorder. The vestibule is part of the inner ear. Just a reminder, the parts of the inner ear include the cochlea, which is the nerves for hearing, the vestibule with the receptors for balance, and the semicircular canals. These are two canals. I'm remembering utricle and saccule. I may be wrong on that, but at any rate, they're fluid-filled, and they do have some tiny crystals in them, and that tells your brain which way is up, depending on how those crystals float. Now, if those crystals aggregate, they can fool your inner ear and keep it from determining exactly which way is up, and that's the problem. There are two types of vertigo, peripheral or central. Peripheral comes from the inner ear itself, and the most common form of peripheral vertigo is something called benign, not malignant, paroxysmal, occurring episodically, positional vertigo. You get into a certain position and you start spinning. You get out of that position, you don't spin. Traditionally, this is something, if you get very, very dizzy and you start spinning when you lie down, that's probably going to be benign paroxysmal positional vertigo. They believe, and I say believe, I mean the story, the theory of this right now, which seems pretty solid, is that there are tiny stones that aggregate in those semicircular canals. They cause the balance center to misinterpret which way is up, and so you're constantly changing which way is up rather than having a constant sense of which way is up. Not sure why they dislodge. This can occur if you get hit in the head. It'll knock those stones loose, and it may account for some of the dizziness after head trauma. It can occur with dental work. Also, some medications make it more likely to occur. So that is BPPV, benign paroxysmal positional vertigo, the most common, we think, cause. And this is still a theory. The idea of these cantiliths, these stones in those canals, is a theory. Not entirely proven yet, but it makes sense, and it works for therapy. Other triggers, again, within the vestibule, Meniere's disease, everyone's heard of that. 1 to 2 cases per 10,000. And these are longer episodes of spinning, 20 minutes, sometimes more than several hours. And also, you get a ringing of your ear. They, instead of just affecting the balance center, they also affect the nerve of hearing, the eighth nerve that goes into your brain. So when you have fullness of the ear, episodes of vertigo that last a long time, ringing of the ear and hearing loss, we diagnose that clinically. Now, here's the thing, though. Do you have the cantiliths or do you have the Meniere's disease? It's a clinical diagnosis. We can't run a lab test. We can't run a scan. And that, Carolyn, is why your doctors are vague, is because these are two possible causes. They're treated entirely differently, but we don't know. We're not able to. We differentiate based on judgment, on your history, not on any type of X-ray or laboratory test. And then finally, there's something called labyrinthitis. We used to call that an inner ear infection because we do think that viruses may be a cause of that. They mentioned herpes simplex virus, rubella, cytomegalovirus, Epstein-Barr virus, adenovirus, which is a cold virus, and some types of influenza can cause irritation and inflammation of the balance center. So you've got the Meniere's disease, which they think is too much fluid in the canals, and we treat that with fluid pills, actually, and a salt-restricted diet. You've got the stones, the canalis, that's the BPBV, and we treat that by getting you to move your head and move those stones and separate them so that they don't put pressure and fool your nerve. And then finally, we've got the labyrinthitis, or we used to call it the inner ear infection, and we don't know what to do for that. Some people have recommended steroid drugs and antiviral medicines. There is no proof that they work. And all of these are clinical diagnoses. If you come in and you've had the flu and you're dizzy, we say that's inner ear infection or labyrinthitis. If you come in with fullness, ringing in the ear, we say that's in long episodes of vertigo, we say that's Meniere's disease. We should try to remove some fluid and maybe use some steroids for that too. And then if you come in with just episodes of dizziness, otherwise you're feeling good, we will have you roll around trying to move those stones away from your ear. So that, again, is the possible, the diagnostic possibilities. That is our sponsor, Vertigo. This one's for you, Carolyn. We are continuing with the idea that we need to change our understanding of things. And I saw this Gallup poll August 8th. 1 in 7 Americans use products that contain cannabidiol, the non-psychoactive compound found in cannabis. You've got the THC, which will make you high. You've got the CBD, which is the other stuff. We're growing it in hemp. It is also present in marijuana, but the hemp has almost no THC, mostly CBD, and other products contain varying amounts. 1 in 7, 14% of U.S. adults use these products. Younger people, West Coast residents, more likely to use cannabis-based goods. Now, the FDA has prohibited the sale of this. They will not allow cannabidiol oil, CBD oil. They have prohibited it from being sold. Hasn't done any good.
No, 1 in 7. I don't think they've done much to prevent it.
Kentucky's economy depends on it, and we are moving ahead full speed. But that is an astonishing number of people using a product that is not supposed to be sold. To the point where, you know, I mean, laws only work if people obey them. And if you got 1 in 7 people who are regularly disobeying this law, it's going to be hard to lock up 14% of the U.S. population or to change, frankly, to change their behavior. This is where we are. So we thought it's time for kind of a new perspective. And I want to be cautious about moving on this because, to be honest with you, I'm still sitting on the fence on CBD oil. Again, it's hemp oil. Kentucky's economy is based on it. I just had a patient come in yesterday. Who is very, very enthusiastic about it. Feels like this is the stuff. Has changed his life. He's back to full activity, and he couldn't get there with arthritis medicines and other interventions. And this has worked for him. I've had several people that said, nothing.
Yeah, so we're back to that place where we aren't really informed on which patients are going to benefit from this, which may have poor outcomes later from some adverse event. And that's my biggest problem with these medications.
Yeah, just don't know. We don't know. And since it's illegal to sell it, it is very difficult to do the research you need. As a matter of fact, one of the comments in one of my references said, none of the pharmaceutical people are doing any type of research on it. They can't. And so this is, I think this is just the public sentiment is going to change. Again, our understanding is going to change, but it's not going to be done in an organized fashion. It's not going to be done under FDA guidance. It's not going to be done based on scientific research. It's just not.
And we aren't sure that all CBD is created equal, right? I mean, all these different products have different amounts,
Right.
You know, what do we recommend if we think it might help?
All right. So first of all, let me go. This was in the AMA Journal. It was on August 9th, came from the Department of Addiction Psychiatry, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, and psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. And I pulled 8 facts out of this review of medical use of cannabis in 2019 from Kevin Hill in the AMA Journal. First fact, nearly 10% of cannabis users in the United States report using it for medicinal purposes. As of August 2019, 33 states and D.C. have policies allowing use of cannabis or cannabinoids, that would include the CBD oil, for management of specific medical conditions, yet the federal government still classifies it as illegal. So we're in a huge mess. 33 states have said use it for these conditions. And this is this could be anything from medical marijuana to hemp oil. Use it for these conditions. They have approved it, and yet the federal government says, no, it's illegal for everything. Fun fact number two, cannabis has these cannabinoids. And again, THC or tetrahydrocannabinol is the stuff that makes you high, the stuff that makes you feel really good, accounting for what they call the psychoactive effects. But then there is the CBD, cannabidiol, approved by the FDA for one thing and one thing only, and that was for a particular type of seizures in children. And it seems to have some benefits there. Dronabinol is a cannabinoid, and that's approved by the FDA for chemotherapy nausea. It seems to have some benefit there. Fun fact number three, the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine examined the indications for these compounds and said there was substantial evidence that cannabis or cannabinoids effectively manage chronic pain. Now, that was a couple of years ago, but that has not been so far not been supported by the science that's come out since then. A recent analysis of 91 publications found they reduced pain 30% more than placebo. They work. However, you have to treat 24 people to get one person with a significant reduction in pain. So you have a lot of people that don't respond. Maybe their pain's different. Maybe they are different. Maybe they respond differently to THC. Don't know. But you have to treat 24 people to get one response. And if you treat six people, you're going to hurt somebody.
Yeah, I don't like those odds.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the problem with using them. They are not risk-free. So the conclusions of the author, again, from Harvard in the AMA Journal, there's only inconclusive evidence that they effectively manage chronic pain. You have to treat large numbers of patients. Many who don't need to receive the treatment will receive it and possibly be harmed.
Yeah, so you would harm four before you could help one.
Yep. There's strong evidence to support relief of symptoms of muscle spasticity from multiple sclerosis, as reported by patients. But when you measure it by physicians, they can't tell that much difference in the muscle spasticity. Other conditions, Parkinson's disease, post-traumatic stress disorder, Tourette's syndrome. Hypothetically, it makes sense to use the relaxing properties of THC. Practically, evidence weak. As I mentioned, few pharmaceutical companies are producing studies, so we've got to go with insufficient evidence to really draw a strong conclusion. So I'll tell you, there are harms, there are benefits. Do the harms outweigh the benefits? Maybe in the information we've got, but we don't have much information. That's what I learned from the AMA Journal. Now, what are the harms? Well, when you're taking marijuana, impaired learning, impaired memory, attention, motor coordination, this could affect your ability to drive and ability to do your job. Judgment is affected. Sometimes you have residual cognitive defects after acute intoxication. That is the next day. Alcohol wears off. You get drunk on Saturday night. You probably can go to work Monday morning. I don't know if you get high on Saturday night whether you're safe Monday morning. Your drug screen is not going to be safe. You may not be safe. Fun fact number seven, it's associated with an increased chronic use, increased risk of psychiatric illness and addiction. It's associated with. We don't know that it causes it, but people who are chronic users have higher rates of psychiatric illness. Now, it may be people with psychiatric illness like medicating themselves with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's certainly with some people, that's the way it works with alcohol.
Yeah, that people self-medicate because it helps some psychiatric symptom they're having.
So it is associated, not necessarily causal. We're not really sure. And so the final conclusion, this is fun fact number eight, if you're keeping count, and I probably skipped a couple, of this AMA Journal article, insufficient evidence exists for the use of medical cannabis for most conditions for which it is advocated. Despite the lack of evidence, various state governments have recommended cannabis for the management of more than 50 medical conditions. And these are not medical recommendations, not scientific recommendations. They are governmental recommendations. A weird position we find ourselves in. Again, 14% of the population using it, 33 states allowing legal use and recommending it for more than 50 conditions, federal government declaring it illegal, and the science not clearly supporting it for anything other than chemotherapy-induced nausea, childhood seizures.
It's a little dysfunctional.
Yeah. And so in some way or another, and this is going to be tough. Now, Canada has legalized recreational marijuana. We're going to learn a lot observationally about it from them and from the states that have gone ahead, unless the federal government in the U.S. decides to shut them down, and I think that would be very difficult. I'm learning from my patients one at a time, but it's not really very good science. You know, ideally, I'd like to have half of them taking it, half of them not. Control for other things like how much pain they're in, what their functional category was the first time, how old are they. None of that stuff is happening. We're just simply watching people use it willy-nilly and seeing whether enough people benefit to outweigh the risk, and we don't know what the risk is. And so hey, it's pretty frustrating. So into this mess comes Peter Cohen and Joshua Sharfstein, Harvard and Johns Hopkins, respectively, New England Journal of Medicine, and this was 2 weeks before this show airs, the opportunity to reform the law. Again, $200 million revenue coming from specifically from CBD products, from hemp oil products. Kentucky, again, has bet the farm that this is going to take off, and it certainly has. It has been a boon to our farmers, and you can buy hemp products pretty much anywhere in the state of Kentucky. The FDA has taken the position that it's a drug. It's a drug. It's a drug. It is right now approved to treat seizures, and when that happened, it became a drug. And you can't have a drug in one situation that is a supplement or a food in another situation. We're going to regulate it as a drug, and everything else is illegal. And so they're desperately now trying to put the water back in the lake after the dam is broken. And not, as you might imagine, not doing too well with that. We're going to take a breath, though, and we're going to come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Why Does the Hubble Constant Change So Much show.
Which you never answered.
No, I like I said.
I mean, honestly, you're going to leave, once again, you're going to leave our listeners completely hanging.
Well, and if you can explain how fast the universe is expanding, then you get the mic and it's your show.
I can explain how slow this show seems to be going.
The universe only looks like it's expanding fast because it's
we're going slow.
It's such a painful radio show. I see it. Okay. That's why no one can measure the Hubble constant, because it depends on whether we're on the air or not.
Hubble must have been somebody important, because we got a lot of things space named Hubble.
Oh, Hubble's a... He was a great guy. We'll talk about him maybe next time. But at any rate,
maybe.
This just happened. I was looking at how things have changed, and I was thinking about the astrophysicist, how they say we need to change our understanding if things don't make sense. And I was thinking to myself, yeah, there's a lot of things I need to change my understanding on. So we talked
like
110-year-olds.
About,
yeah, for vertigo and for Carolyn. I didn't hear what you said, so I just said yeah, didn't I?
Like 110-year-old people.
Okay, so there's one. Most 110-year-olds are liars. I'm sorry. I don't want to speak.
You don't like old
the,
people, do you?
I'm getting that feeling.
I love truthfully old people. What I hate is people in their 60s collecting.
Let's be honest. You just strongly dislike it. You don't hate it.
No.
You strongly dislike it.
That's right. I love the.
That's me keeping
I love,
you honest.
I hate the centenary. I love the centenarian. How about that?
You strongly dislike
okay.
them.
Okay.
Oh, I love it. A good pun. Worth the end of the show on, isn't it? But we talked about that. We talked about the change in the nature of cannabidiol, the fact that it is technically illegal, but it is absolutely exploding everywhere, use of CBD oil. We see it in the clinic on a daily basis. Half the people are really just unimpressed, and the other half swear this is the most miraculous thing that's ever happened to them. And so I'm still looking. But I know that some people get a great response to CBD oil, particularly for conditions like arthritis and chronic pain problems, which many of my patients have. Some of them starting to get in their 80s and 90s, no one reaching 110, of course. But That's another issue. And then the other thing we're talking about is, why is it so hard to understand vertigo and inner ear problems? And I want to stress, I mean, I've divided these things up. Remember what we talked about, BPPV, benign positional paroxysmal vertigo. I believe that's benign paroxysmal positional vertigo.
Yes.
This is where you have some small crystals in your inner ear balance apparatus, and they press against the nerves. I'll make it simple. And that causes you to misunderstand which way is up. You feel you're spinning or the room's spinning. And there are some repositioning. If you Google this thing or if you look on YouTube, they will show you how to roll your head. Sort of like the maze that you used to roll to try to get a marble to drop through a hole. You've got to get those crystals away from the balance center, and so you roll your head to move them back down the canal away from it, and it seems to work pretty well. We had some isolated instances of people being cured of vertigo while riding a roller coaster, and we put together this theory that there are those crystals there, and it makes the best sense of anything that I've heard. There is also Meniere's disease, and the current thinking on Meniere's disease, which involves ringing in the ears, hearing loss, and the sensation of vertigo or spinning over a longer period of time. Maybe there's too much fluid in these canals. And not necessarily the crystals are the problem, but there's too much fluid, and so we do a salt-restricted diet and we use fluid medicines. And then finally, there's the old inner ear infections. I never understood these. I mean, if you wipe out your eardrum, you could get some problems with the cochlea. You can get some problems with, well, you can get a brain infection, for that matter, if it ruptures through the eardrum. But how in the world a cold virus or a flu virus gets in behind your eardrum and causes any changes in your balance center is a mystery to me. But supposedly it can. Labyrinthitis. And we're still trying to figure out what to do with that. And keep in mind, there are no diagnostic tests to differentiate any of these causes. It is based on the history that you give the doctor and the exam findings, not so much. But really, if you say, I have short bursts of vertigo and spinning when I move my head, you have BPPV. If you have ringing in your ears, pressure sensation, hearing loss, and longer spells of spinning, you have Meniere's disease. And then if you happen to have had a virus infection, we figure you've got labyrinthitis. Make sense? And it's all, like I said, it's all theoretical. None of that is absolutely proven.
I mean, Tony, it's possible to induce this in a normal person, right? I mean,
oh, absolutely. I put you on a merry-go-round or, you know, office chair. Just spin the office chair and you get vertigo.
Well, I was trying to open up the dialogue. I am a certified pilot and I do understand about vertigo, but I was just trying to get you to...
Wow, you said I am a certified. I thought, wow, where is this going? He's a certified vertigo inducer. You can do it in the... You could do it in a home setting.
Look,
and Rick apparently will come into your home and make you dizzy.
I would tell you straight up, you can do it in an airplane. You just don't want to.
and that's fair. Frankly,
want to be right side up in an airplane. Trust me.
Right.
But it is true. A lot of pilots, a lot of people experience vertigo when they get into instrument training.
Yeah.
And they lose track of the horizon. If you can look down, you can get those ear canals in the right form, and you bring them back up, and you look back up at your gauges, you can induce a complete vertigo. Matter of fact, it's cool. If you go to some of the air shows, the FAA and some of the safety, national NTSB, you know, they have demonstrations they'll set up and put you in basically a vertigo-inducing machine. And they'll have you in a cockpit, and you look down. They'll have you do a routine, and you'll look down. You'll look back up, and all of a sudden, the plane is upside down. I mean, you literally fly the plane upside down because you think you're upside down, and so you turn it right side up, which makes you upside down.
Right. So zero G does that? I mean, you think, okay, I can handle this. I mean, and also movement on the ocean, that up-down movement.
Oh, yeah.
These are things that you have no control over. I mean, you try to focus your eyes on the horizon.
I
mean,
I feel
so
sorry for the people that have to deal with this on a regular basis because of an illness.
Right.
But the people, you know, you can make yourself, I mean, a normal human deals with this in certain scenarios no matter what.
And certain medications can have this as a side effect, which is really, really annoying. A couple of other things about vertigo. It can persist for a lifetime, but that is rare. You can't have... Now, we talked about this balance center and all the things that can happen to it.
Have you ever met somebody who you thought had vertigo for life?
I have not. I will tell you a couple of stories, though, in just a second. I want to get to this, though. There is something called central vertigo, and that's basically at the other end of the nerve, the brain. If you have a stroke, you can have a stroke of the area that controls your balance, and it can produce some very, very severe problems that last basically the rest of your life with not necessarily spinning, but just with balance in general. You lose your ability to right yourself, and the rest of your life you're constantly falling, and you're not really certain of which way's up so much. So that is central vertigo, and that's one of the reasons why if an elderly person, particularly somebody who has a lot of circulation problems, if they suddenly develop pretty severe vertigo and spinning, we'll go to the emergency room and they'll run an MRI scan looking at the back of the brain to see if they can see signs of a stroke. It affects millions of people of all ages. Women are 3 times more likely to develop vertigo than men. We have no idea why that's so. Perhaps it has to do with mineral composition of these cannoliths. We're not really sure. There are medications. Again, meclizine, just in general, it's an antihistamine, but it does have some effects to try to treat vertigo. You can get that. If it is caused by migraines or other conditions, you treat that. And as I mentioned, you can use fluid medicines for Meniere's disease, possibly antivirals. Sometimes steroids are used as well, but the benefits are not always clear from the medications. Physical therapy, very, very handy for many of the conditions that lead to balance problems. And then things like dancing can make it better. Now, Rick, you asked me about the two most severe cases I had of vertigo. I still remember well. One of them was in a truck driver. And my argument was this guy looks straight ahead all the time as a truck driver. He glanced to the mirror. Mm-hmm. But he spent a lot of time looking straight ahead. And when he tried to turn his head to the side, all of a sudden he was not able to do it. I think whatever happened to his anatomy, it aligned in such a position that everything was fine as long as his head was straight, facing straight forward. The other one, which made me start thinking about this, was a guy who had really bad arthritis in his neck. He could not turn his head, and he wound up being hospitalized for a very severe spell of vertigo. Now, this may have been a coincidence, but I think one of the things that happens to us as kids is, you know, we're hanging upside down from a tree, we're doing somersaults, we're rolling down the hill. We put a lot of stress on our balance center, and it learns to accommodate. Whereas as we get older, we do less, and certainly if we are a truck driver or we have arthritis, we do almost no stress at all. And so anything that happens that turns your head from one side to the other can cause problems. So they mentioned dancing, and I think head movements other than having your head straight forward may actually help prevent vertigo.
Shelley, I think we're going to need to look forward when we're recording this and quit looking sideways at Tony.
Yeah, I think so.
It's going to be a health hazard.
Yeah, I think I'm going to get vertigo when I have to look at my computer tomorrow morning.
Yeah, I mean, Tony's single-handedly ruining us.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to see a lot more cases of vertigo.
Imagine what if I used my other hand, how much I could ruin.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, that's our sponsor
that was funny.
For the final time. Wasn't it, though? I mean, that was almost a joke.
I almost got a laugh out
of that. Yeah. This is vertigo. This one's for you, Carol. Now, next up.
Carol, we really hacked on that for you, didn't we?
I made it absolutely.
That'll teach you to ask for.
Crystal clear about everything you need to know about vertigo. It is a mess in terms of diagnosis. This one was from August 8th. It was in the New York Times, and it was by a woman named Ann Bauer. And she says, during an extended period of travel last year, my husband and I lent our house in the Ozarks to an older couple who were having work done on their house. We returned, and the house was spotless. There were two gifts there, but there was a distinctive smell in the air, slightly stale, slightly sweet, the musty first whiff of strawberries in a cardboard box. That's what you thought. I wiped the countertops, mopped the floors, but that odor remained. It was not terrible, but it was just strange. She started wondering, do old people smell?
Don't you think her description is oddly specific?
The musty first whiff of strawberries in a cardboard box.
That seems oddly specific.
Yes.
Do you tend to listen to people who are that specific?
You think, well, she's a writer. Well, I mean,
it's overly sensitive.
I know but the thing is, she makes, you know, there was kind of an odor, you know. But she's a writer. She is poetic. She's using poetic license to try to give you some.
Do you like people who use poetic license
of the odor? Well, I enjoy reading.
Do you
their
use
stuff.
Poetic license when you're writing your medical record?
No. Well, I repeat what the patient. If the patient's poetic, if they, you know, if they say I flew
Romeo,
through the air.
Romeo, where?
No. Before I fell, I flew through the air like a bat from Australia. I'm going to put that in the record because that's cute. All right, we keep going. So she started looking. Do old people smell? Johan Lundstrom, who is a 46-year-old biologist with Monell Chemical Research Center. Japanese have researchers have done this, and they have found something, an aldehyde called 2-nonanol, and it's more concentrated on the skin of older people, and it smells kind of grassy, waxy, that kind of smell. So they have a chemical on their skin that theoretically might produce an odor.
At least in Japan.
Right. And so Lundstrom, he had a small study. People ages 20 to 95 used samples from their underarms, presented them to 40, and this is that old smell with my underarm thing. 41 participants who ranked them on the intensity and unpleasantness, they found that they were able to assign age labels to the body odors originating from the old people, but not the other age groups. Now, another organic chemistry, also with the Monell Chemical Research Center, said he used upper back and forearm samples, put them through the gas chromatograph, and couldn't find any difference at all. So, two possible outcomes there. Universally, if you look at all the studies of smelling old people, in blind smell tests, where you don't know what you're smelling, the odor of middle-aged men is judged to be the worst. Rick?
The worst.
I'm not middle-aged. I'm older than that.
I would call you, from where I am, you are middle-aged.
You're older than me.
That's right. So you're not young. I'm older.
I am closer to 100 than I am to zero.
Right. That's the definition of middle age.
So what is the middle age range?
No, middle age in our country is what, 81, 78, something.
What?
No, I'm saying our average age. I'm sorry, average age.
All right. Life expectancy.
What's life expectancy?
79.
So yeah. What's half of that?
Yeah, half of that is 38.
So there's middle 39. Age.
Okay, so in 40,
right?
40
technically,
to 50.
Didn't we just do a math problem?
40 so to 50 40 would be middle aged.
Would it? Wouldn't it be more like 5 years before and 5 years after? That would be middle age?
No, I mean, you got to take out that teenage and
don't you
infants.
Understand what a mean is?
Yeah,
a,
I understand,
a
but you start being an adult at age 21.
No, this is a math problem. This isn't an this isn't an attitude problem.
I understand,
problem.
But I'm saying if you wouldn't say I'm a young adult when I'm 2. You would say I'm an infant.
But so, I wouldn't say I'm middle age when I'm 58.
That's a bit old.
How old are you?
I'm not middle-aged. I'm not saying I'm middle-aged, Rick. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that middle-aged men universally are judged to have the worst smell.
And I'm saying those people are in their 40s.
This is great. We've got a new producer today. Shamari Moses here.
She's not new. Back in she's
school.
Just back.
I know. And she's here. And, you know, I think I'm looking at her. And look at her nodding her head. She's saying, yes, I agree with you.
No, she's saying
Rick
you
smells
smell.
The worst.
No, she's saying she's, you smell.
Well, you notice she's on my side of the studio. I'm pointing that out. Now, here.
That means she's closer to you.
Means
she's getting more smell.
That's her decision. Anyway,
Shelly? You're going to be a tiebreaker here.
Wait a second. Middle-aged women, despite all our fears to the contrary, smell the best.
Well, thank you. See? The producer agrees.
Now,
men did this study.
Yeah, men did the study.
I mean, come on. Let's be honest. They're never going to say.
Married men did the study.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
They're men or men.
No, I would married agree. Men did the study.
Yeah, they're not going to. You're right on that.
I could not imagine any other outcome.
All right, but they mentioned in Japan they have a name for the older person older. And I know.
El Stinky?
No, it's Kureshu, I guess. I don't know how to say it. But it's negative. There's a company that actually makes a $16 persimmon soap bar to eliminate the offensive smell of old people.
Well, now, wait a minute. You can't say old people smell offensive on the radio. You're going to make our fans upset.
I'm reading it. I'm reading it.
Hey, Tony, what's the average age of our listeners?
I would say most of them are middle-aged.
Uh-huh. Me and you have a real problem with middle age because I think middle age is younger than you think.
Well, for the record, I have fond memories of my grandparents smelling like butterscotch.
Go figure.
But that's not bad smelling.
No, that's what I'm saying.
Did they, was this just their intrinsic, I mean, did they make a lot of butterscotch?
No, they had butterscotch candy, you know, the little hard butterscotch candy.
Well, see, but I think Shelly's on to something. I think, you know, my grandparents' house smelled different, but I wouldn't say it bad. I think they're categorizing old people as smelling bad. I think they just smell different.
Okay, Rick, you're so different. Why don't you get us off the air?
All right, we're getting out of here. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, who's got a difficult job, Shamari Mosley, and Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember this message from former Major League Baseball player Frank Thomas for our male listeners.
Health Matters can make you a big hunk who looks like he still might be playing professional sports. If your wife wishes, you would use Health Matters like Frank Thomas does. You can text DONATE $50 to Morehead State Public Radio.
We will send a free radio show of award-winning Health Matters, the number one selling free testosterone booster radio show on Morehead State Public Radio.
Health Matters is a unique man-boosting radio show powered by RadioFin, a patented key ingredient clinically researched to help boost your testosterone levels, to help you feel stronger, leaner, with more energy and drive, more passion, too.
Why not try a show and trust Frank Thomas? She will like it, too. Remember, text DONATE $50 to Morehead State Public Radio to get a free complimentary Health Matters radio show this weekend.
These free radio samples are not available in stores.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.